to just make such ifs, saying that if this takes place, that will happen. This will just create a state of confusion with respect to the country's economy, such as that must be avoided in order to contribute to the boosting of the economy. And speaking of this year's motto, that is elimination of obstacles and providing supports, that must be realized. But regarding the presidential elections and the council elections that will be held in almost 3 months, this is very, very important, and I have to mention some points in this regard. The first point is the importance of elections. The elections are of paramount importance, both domestically and from the foreign perspective. Domestically speaking, that is an act of renovation. Elections can be considered as an act of renovation. That means new energetic individuals will hold the office, and there will be a renovation of the executive branch, and that will inject new energy because the executive branch shoulders a very heavy responsibility, and that will renovate that branch, and new motivated individuals will become operational. From the foreign perspective, people's participation indicates national might and power. This must be admitted, that the diplomacy, the defensive power, that will add to our might. But more than all of these, it's the nation that gives power to the country. So when all realize, the enemy is realized that the people are vigilant, is highly motivated, that will add to the might and power of that nation. So people's turnout will add to the country's power, and the elections can be considered as a manifestation of public participation and also revolutionary gatherings, but more important is the elections. I have spoken about the strong Iran before. That means we have to make efforts in order to make the country stronger. One can see the animosities by the enemies, the hegemonic systems. So to make the country stronger, that's a general motto. The one who does not agree with me also agrees with having a stronger Iran, and to have a stronger Iran is much better than having a weak country that one can be humiliated by others. So to have a stronger Iran with dignity, that's much better. Who does grant such a strength to the country? That's the people who give a strength to the country. And people's participation and the issue of participation and the enormity of their participation will affect such a national strength. I should also add this. This is based on our information. The people should know that the intelligence and espionage services by certain countries, and namely the Zionist regime and the United States, their espionage apparatus since a while ago, they are making efforts in order to undermine public participation in the elections, or they are just leveling allegations against the organizers. They say that they claim that the elections have been engineered, and there are leveling allegations against the organizers or the Guardians Council, or they seek to cause frustration amongst the people, claiming that people's vote have no impact, and they are intensively pursuing this process, and they are making maximum use of cyberspace. Unfortunately, our country's cyberspace, despite the emphasis I put, the necessary measures have not been taken, has been just left as it is, and the authorities must be aware of this, and all world countries are managing their cyberspaces. We are proud that we have just left it as it is. This is not a source of pride. The cyberspace must be managed. The people should make use of this space. It's a tool for freedom for the people, but this tool must not be put at the disposal of the enemy, because the enemies are going to conspire, make conspiracies against the country. And the enemy's objective is to make use of psychological methods in order to reduce public participation in the elections and I hope that the people would respond to the enemy and make the and disappoint the enemy. That's the first issue with regard to the importance of elections. The second point is about the importance of presidency. It's of great significance. It's the most important and effective management in the country. It's been said in the past few years, once in a while, that the president has no authority, is just in charge of providing logistics, and they just make calculations. I don't know how they make such calculations. They say the president has authority only 12 to 15%. These are due to irresponsible approach, or due to lack of awareness, or perhaps maybe due to a biased approach. But I have to say that the position of the president is the has the highest authority, with the heaviest responsibility, shouldering the heaviest responsibility, and all the managerial positions of the country operate under the president. The judiciary has managerial positions, or the military has managerial positions, and compared to the presidency, they are a little bit more than 0%. In other words, almost all managerial positions, thousands of managerial positions in the country, operate under the head of the executive branch, and the approved the whole budget, the approved budget, is at the disposal of the president, and the president has the authority over the budget, and the majority of the capacities and facilities are at the disposal of the president. So that's the significance of the presidency. So when you want to elect the president, and see, and that shows the responsibility that we have for electing the president, and my vote is equal to a vote cast by a 16 or 17 year old boy. So that shows the responsibility shouldered by the president. The third point is related to the candidates. Some individuals have voiced readiness to become candidates, and I expect you to know the importance of this responsibility. to see what sort of responsibility you have to shoulder, the burden that you have to shoulder. You should know this. If you're capable, go ahead and enter the presidential campaign, but you should be aware of the burden that you shoulder. You should be aware of the major issues in the country. It's not just one or two issues. There are hundreds of issues. At least tens of these issues are amongst the fundamental issues. You should be aware of the problems faced by the country. What are these problems? And you should have a solution, even a brief solution, not even a detailed one. You should at least have a brief solution for tackling these problems. You should be familiar with the economy. That includes national investment, national production, inflation, and the strengthening the national currency. Also, the country's security is of paramount importance, social, the issue of social harms. That's also an important matter in the country. Also, confronting the complicated policies in the world, foreign policy, the important matter of culture. You should be aware of the ongoing situation in the country. What are the expectations? What should be done? If you are capable of shouldering this heavy burden, go ahead. And if not, refrain from entering this campaign, because according to your religious narration, if one shoulders the responsibility, he has been warned about it. I'm not going to elaborate on that. Another issue is related to the public. To be aware of the characteristics of a qualified president. I'm going to mention this. See, that's not my personal view. It seems that whoever is after country's happiness must have these features. He should be competent, in management. He should be faithful. If he lacks faith, he cannot be trusted. A person with no faith may even sell national interests. He should be a justice seeker. He should be he should combat corruption. That's one of the important features of a president, and must go after the administration of justice and combat corruption in its real sense. Must have jihadi and revolutionary performance. In fact, one should act in a jihadi and revolutionary way. And avoid acting in the opposite way. Must believe in the domestic capabilities. Some do not believe in domestic capabilities and just think that only very simple things can be produced. And I, in fact, recommended the officials to take part in a defensive tour in order to learn about our defensive capabilities. The president must believe in the abilities of young people, and the youths must be considered as the playing a leading role, and the president must trust young people. And I had a close relationship with young people, and I do trust young people. And whenever we have participation by young people, major problems can be solved. I do not want to name anyone, the president must have a popular base, must have a popular basis, and must not be skeptical. And if such a person can manage the problems, one can be certain that that will make breakthroughs. It's not easy to find such a person, and the people can just look for such a person, make questions, and so on. But these are the features that one must seek in the presidential candidate. And we have to ask God to help and assist the nation in order to find such an individual with the set characteristics. And the last point regarding elections is that our dear nation must consider elections as the icon of national unity. It must not be considered as an icon of disunity. It must not be considered as an icon of bipolarity. These wrong divisions, the right and the left and so on, must be set aside. What matters is the future of the country, the future of generation, and what matters is a dignified Islamic establishment in the country. These are the things that matter, and these are the issues that must be taken into account and support one another, act in a unified manner. Of course, there are different political orientations and tastes and different beliefs, and these do exist, but they should not harm national unity. The nation must stay united and avoid bipolarization of the country. And the last point is related to JCPOA and regional developments. I'm going to say a few words about this. The first point is that the U.S. maximum pressure policy has failed. And the last idiot designed this maximum pressure policy and implemented it in order to cause Iran's weakness. And due to weakness, Iran would be forced to come to the negotiation table, and then he would just put forth his hegemonic demands and impose his hegemonic wishes on a weak Iran. He was lost with that. He left office in a scandalous manner, and that even caused a scandal for the U.S. And thank God, the Islamic Republic is standing firmly and dignified. So they should know that so far the maximum pressure policy has failed. And if the new U.S. administration, if they want to continue maximum pressure, they will also fail. They will be lost, and the Islamic Iran will remain with more strength and firmness, and our recommendations will make this country stronger on a daily basis. The second point is that the country's policy with regard to interaction with the JCPOA parties and the JCPOA itself has been explicitly declared, and one should not violate this policy. This is a declared policy based on unanimity. This is not an exceptional policy. It's a policy based on unanimity, and based on this policy, the Americans must lift all the sanctions, which we have to verify it. If they are lifted in the true sense, then we will return to our commitments. That's our definite policy. We do not consider U.S. promises as being credible. We do not trust them to claim that we're going to just lift the sanctions on the paper. That's not acceptable. They should lift the sanctions in practice. They should take action. We verify them, and then we're going to return to our commitments. Some Americans are expressing views about the JCPOA. Some say that when the deal was signed in 1394 and 95, some say that the situation has changed and then the deal must undergo changes. I agree that the situation has changed, but the change is not to the U.S. benefit. The change has been to our own benefit. There has been a change to the benefit of Iran. From 1394 till today, Iran has become much stronger and has increased self-reliance. But from 1394 till now, the U.S. administration has lost all its prestige due to the ruling administration, and that caused a scandal in the U.S. and the major economic problems there. So the situation has changed to the detriment of the Americans. So if any change is to be made to the deal, that must be to the benefit of Iran. We have made the sanctions ineffective. We have ample science-based companies, major breakthroughs by the youths, and various innovations. And hopefully we're going to continue this path, but the Americans have faced more problems on a daily basis, and it's not clear what will be the fate of this president who is in office today in the U.S. So we are not in a hurry with respect to the solution we have proposed. Some say that one should not lose the opportunity. We believe that the opportunities must be used, but at the same time, we should not act in a hasty manner. To act hastily, in some cases, it will be to our detriment. To act hastily will be to our detriment. With regard to JCPOA, we acted in a hurried manner, in a hasty manner, and so the other parties did not fulfill their commitments based on the JCPOA. So this is a very important matter that we are patient, we are pursuing our path. If they accept this policy and enforce it, then everything will be fine. Otherwise, the same situation will continue, and there's nothing wrong with it. I heard from some world politicians saying that, does it make any difference whether which party is going to take the first action? That's not the matter. The fact is that we trusted the Americans at the time of Obama, and we fulfilled our commitments based on the nuclear deal, but they did not fulfill their commitments. They said on paper that the sanctions will be lifted, but any company that wanted to sign a contract with us, they said that this will be a risky contract. And they intimidated the investors. That's why we do not trust them. And their promise is of no credibility or value for us. But the Americans made a mistake in dealing with us. And regarding the regional developments, the Americans are making a mistake. They continue to make mistakes, and they're tyrannical, and they are fully supporting the Zionist regime. The Americans fully support the Zionist regime. That's a mistake, and they have presence in Syria, and also they support Saudis in attacking the Yemeni people and the Americans' policies with regard to Palestine. These are all wrong policies, and the issue of Palestine will never be forgotten in the world of Islam. They think that in a few humiliated governments, they have established ties with the Zionist regime. They have pinned hope on this, on normalization of ties. And these have two or three such governments cannot leave an impact. The Muslim Ummah will never forget the issue of Palestine and will never overlook the Palestinian issue. The Americans must know this. The same is true about the developments in Yemen. The aggression against Yemen started during the democratic rule prior to Trump. Trump did not start the war. The Yemen war started at the time of the democratic administration of Obama with the U.S. green light. The U.S. allowed the Saudis to start the war and helped the Saudis, provided the Saudis with ample military support in order to bombard the defenseless people of Yemen to force them to surrender. But they made a mistake. 6 years have passed, and they have failed. And attacks started in such days 6 years ago, and they have failed to make the Yemenis surrender. I ask the Americans, the day that you showed the green light to the Saudis to start the Yemen war, did you know the outcome? Did you know the quagmire that the Saudis are stuck in today? They have, and that's a mutual problem for the Saudis. They cannot halt the war, and they cannot continue the war. And both options will be to the Saudis' detriment. Did the Americans know what problem they are causing for the Saudis? If you knew that, then that will be very horrible for your allies. And if you didn't know, that will be also a horrible situation for the allies that trust you and implement and design their plans in conformity with your views, because you are unfamiliar with the ongoing situation in the region. So you do not know this region, you do not know the nations of this region, and you're making a mistake. And may God guide all those who have been deceived, and may God make the Iranian nation stronger and provide them with more welfare and make them happy and prosperous. And please the heart of the Imam of the time, and make our nation benefit from his prayers. I salute the pure soul of the late Imam. I salute the pure souls of the martyrs.
Dear listeners, what you heard was the annual speech of leader of Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei on the occasion of Nowruz, marking Iranian New Year. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, first of all, extended felicitations to Iranian nation on the occasion of Nowruz. The leader also called on Iranian officials to eliminate obstacles regarding production. Ayatollah Khamenei also called for elimination obstacles by cutting hands of middlemen and ending corruption. The leader of Islamic Revolution said Iran's economy enjoys ample capacities and requires a comprehensive plan. The leader also said Iran ranks 18 among world nations in terms of economy despite sanctions. The leader of Islamic Revolution said Iran enjoys young and educated working population as evidenced by World Bank. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said Iran could ward off impact of sanctions through economic development. Also, the leader of Islamic Revolution condemned U.S. sanctions against Iran as a major criminal act. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said Iran managed to achieve self-sufficiency in certain areas amid cruel sanctions. Also, the leader said Iran achieved self-sufficiency in production of equipment needed to fight coronavirus pandemic. And also, the leader said Iran makes brilliant progress in production of defensive and military capabilities. The leader of Islamic Revolution has stressed importance of upcoming presidential election in Iran and said elections actually the leader of Islamic Revolution described elections as active renovation in Iran's executive branch of government. The leader also called for mass turnout in upcoming polls to better defend Iran's sovereignty. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei also called on Iranian officials to manage cyberspace and disappoint enemies. The leader reiterated importance of position of president and executive branch in Iran. The leader called on Iranian nation to elect competent and faithful president. Also, the leader said U.S. maximum pressure policy has failed. The leader of Islamic Revolution said new U.S. government will fail too if maximum pressure policy continued. Also, the leader said Iran will comply with JCPOA commitments after all sanctions removed and verified by Iran. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said U.S. government suffering back-to-back scandals and huge economic problems. The leader said Iran is in no hurry for other parties to return to JCPOA compliance. Also, the leader said U.S. government making big mistake by supporting illegitimate Zionist regime. The leader said Muslim nations will never leave Palestinian people alone. And also, Ayatollah Khamenei said U.S.-backed Saudi-led invasion has turned Yemen into quagmire for Saudis. Dear listeners, many thanks for being with IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. What you just heard was our special coverage. We now return to our normal course of programs.
Sanctions are a topic that often go underreported. They're seen by most people as being some kind of tame, mild alternative to war. But they're just as destructive as war, if not more. They're a modern equivalent of siege warfare, just like when armies would surround a city, cutting off its food supplies and isolating the inhabitants until they either surrendered or died of malnutrition and disease. Today, I want to talk about two countries, Venezuela and Syria, that are subject to some of the worst sanctions, although they're not the only ones. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. The United States has been trying to topple the governments of Venezuela and Syria for a while now. Independent socialist countries who refuse to serve the financial and geopolitical interests of the United States usually do end up being couped, invaded, or sanctioned, sometimes all three. After all, this isn't something new. There isn't a country in Central or Latin America that the United States hasn't meddled in. We've seen the United States overthrow the democratically elected president of Guatemala in 1954. We saw a CIA-backed coup in Chile in 1973. The United States was financing death squads in Nicaragua and El Salvador in the 1980s, bombing Grenada in 1983, and much more. It's quite an extensive list. And it's important, of course, to underline this and point out the recent history, just so that there's no illusions of what's going on here. The United States and their partners are interested in regime change, and will do so for economic reasons, as they have done so in the past. Again, it's no coincidence that Venezuela, besides being an anti-imperialist socialist nation, also happens to sit on the world's largest reserves of oil. Now, sanctions against Venezuela date back to the days of the Bush regime. Every U.S. president since has taken steps to expand the embargo on Venezuela. In 2014 and 2015, Barack Obama imposed further sanctions on Venezuela, freezing assets and issuing travel bans. Then when Donald Trump took over as president, he imposed even more sanctions as part of his maximum pressure campaign. In January 2019, Trump targeted Venezuela's oil sector. The oil embargo included the Trump administration blocking sales from Venezuela's state-owned oil company, PDVSA, and then seizing its U.S. subsidiary, Citgo, which is worth billions. Remember, Venezuela relies heavily on its exports of oil for that stream of revenue, and Trump also proceeded to target its financial sector in March 2019 and its defense and security sector in May 2019. Now, although the United States claims it imposes sanctions to punish certain government officials and ministers for, you know, alleged human rights abuses and cracking down on protesters, something the United States has no problem doing on its own citizens, the United States isn't acting as some kind of benevolent moral arbiter. It wants to replace the Venezuelan government with someone more favorable to the interests of Washington, D.C., which is why the United States has been propping up the former leader of the National Assembly in Venezuela, Juan Guaido. This guy, who most Venezuelans haven't even heard of, is essentially their stooge. He's a puppet that they want to put in place in order to further their political and economic interests. As per usual, the European Union followed the lead of the United States and also imposed sanctions on Venezuela and also proceeded to push Juan Guaido as the supposed interim president of Venezuela. Now, whatever issues Venezuela had internally, these sanctions have only served to exacerbate them and as a result have spurred on one of the worst displacement crises in the world. According to the United Nations, worldwide, there are over 5 million Venezuelan refugees and migrants, and over 800,000 asylum seekers, and 2.5 million living under other legal forms of stay in the Americas. Sanctions make life hell for the people living there, and this is precisely why so many people are fleeing. The poverty rate has reached record levels and plunged the Venezuelan people into unimaginably cruel conditions. Since Venezuela's economy is so heavily dependent on oil, by blocking Venezuela from selling its oil and stealing its companies, the U.S. is essentially cutting off funding for social services and government infrastructure. They know this, and they do this anyway, hoping that the people will rise up and overthrow their government. To further examine the harsh realities of economic sanctions, I'm joined by Alina Duhan. She is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of the unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights, or sanctions. She's also a professor of international law at the Belarusian State University, and she just returned recently from Venezuela. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on the program, Professor. It's good to have you.
It's a pleasure for me.
I wanted to ask you if you could maybe further explain the mechanism of how these sanctions can end up being so devastating for the local currency of another country and freezing the assets as well and so forth. And also how that ties into Syria, because the Syrian pound is also experiencing this hyperinflation, specifically after the implementation of the Caesar Act sanctions in June 2020.
The economic situation as well as hyperinflation started to develop in Venezuela as soon as the oil prices started to drop, starting from 2013. So there was a serious economic decrease. And the hyperinflation has already started at that point. When we speak about Syria, the Syrian economy has already been devastated by years of conflict over the years. So we need to take into account that the situation was already far from good one before sanctions have been imposed. Countries, for example, Venezuela can't sell oil anymore. If we compare with 2015 and 2016, when sanctions started to be imposed, the revenue of Venezuela from selling oil dropped from 100% to 1%. So they started to get only 1% of the money they used to get because of selling oil. The mining sector of Venezuela has also been listed, and therefore they can't sell anything, can't export anything they used to get from the mining sector as well. That's why the income has dropped even further. That the assets Venezuela had in the banks of the United States, United Kingdom, and Portugal, which upon different assessments were between $5 and $6 billion, have been frozen. The country is losing income and can't pay to social services. And as a result, a lot of social projects which used to be supported by the government, in particular, the government used to provide 2 meals per day at schools. So children were fed at schools. Now it's limited to 1, and this 1 is usually very small. It doesn't contain protein. So children do not eat at schools anymore.
And how would you describe the medical and public health infrastructure in Venezuela at the moment? How much have these institutions been further imperiled, generally speaking, by these sanctions?
Before 2016, the government used to provide the full coverage of medical expenses to every citizen of Venezuela. I was visiting the cardiological child hospital. Traditionally, this hospital was doing 1,500 surgeries, heart surgeries for children per year. Last year, this hospital was only able to do 160 surgeries. So it basically means that more than 1,300 children were not able to get this surgery. I was visiting the hospitals both in Caracas and outside of Caracas. And I have been reported that in some of them, they can't even do, for example, the simple blood test because all the centrifuges are already broken. The majority of hospitals demonstrate that about 80% of equipment is already broken because it's impossible to buy spare parts for the equipment. And traditionally, Venezuela was buying the equipment either from the United States or from Europe. And that's a really serious problem.
You know, when the United States announced sanctions, they usually say that they're going to make an exception for humanitarian aid, for relief agencies. Does that actually translate into reality?
In practice, unfortunately, the majority of these humanitarian exceptions doesn't work. First of all, the procedure to get a permission to deliver humanitarian aid is lengthy and costly. That means that only huge humanitarian organizations which have a necessary legal department can be involved into that. A small one can't even effort doing that. Secondly, even if there is a possibility to get a humanitarian exceptions, it still doesn't mean that a company will be able to buy humanitarian goods because of the fear of secondary sanctions. So the majority of banks and the majority of companies outside of the countries will be scared to be involved into transactions. That if you look, for example, at the guidances which have been developed by the European Union as concerns the delivery of humanitarian aid, the burden of proof of the initial humanitarian purpose is laying on humanitarian actors. So the humanitarian organizations face the following situation. They need to find the donors. They need to find a way to get an exception. They need to prove that these goods will only be used for humanitarian purposes, and they will be responsible if anything will happen. That's why they prefer not to be involved that much in this sphere. And that's why I delivered the guidance on delivery of humanitarian aid at the end of 2020. And I called for some steps to be taken to improve situation with humanitarian exception. But the last point, which is also important, is that usually, even if it's possible to get humanitarian exception, these humanitarian exceptions are only referring to medical goods and to food. It's impossible to get a humanitarian exception to anything else. There are enormous problems, for example, to get humanitarian exceptions for something which could be considered as a dual use goods. In Venezuela, there are serious problems with spare parts for the medical equipment, spare parts for water, electricity supply, as well as industry responsible for agriculture. And buying this equipment and buying these spare parts is not never considered to be to fall under humanitarian exceptions.
Alina Duhan, thank you so much for your time. It's a pleasure speaking with you, Professor.
It was a pleasure for me. Thank you for interest.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Similarly to Venezuela, Syria has also been on the receiving end of brutal sanctions imposed by the United States and the European Union, all done in the aim of toppling the Syrian government and effectuating regime change. Syria has undergone the world's worst refugee crisis in modern history. Half of Syria's population has been displaced by this war, even members of my own family. According to the United Nations Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, more than 6.6 million Syrians have been forced to flee their homes since 2011. And another 6.7 million people remain displaced inside the country. And on top of all that suffering, the European Union and the United States don't stop there. It's not enough that Western powers have funded armed groups inside Syria to sow chaos or that Israel helped Al-Qaeda fighters because it suited them to see Syria fall. No, on top of all that, they go ahead and tighten the noose even further on the Syrian people. It's despicable. In June 2020, the Trump regime implemented the Caesar Act. These sanctions are the most severe and extensive sanctions Syria has ever faced, despite having been under sanctions for decades. Right now in Syria, people are queuing up in bread lines. Bread lines in a country that used to grow its own wheat and have enough wheat left over to export to other countries. People now have to wait hours just to get a little bit of bread that isn't even enough to properly feed a family. This wasn't a thing before the war. This was unheard of. People have drawn comparisons between what's happening now and the way hundreds of thousands of Iraqis were viciously starved to death by sanctions in the 1990s. Before the war on Syria started in 2011, one US dollar was equal to 47 Syrian pounds. Now, $1 is equal to 4,000 Syrian pounds on the black market. This devaluation of the currency and hyperinflation brought on by the war and exacerbated by the Caesar sanctions has completely shattered Syria's economy. And of course, given that Lebanon and Syria's economies are inextricably intertwined, and Lebanon is going through its own economic crisis, that doesn't do much to help either. Not only is the United States isolating Syria from the world and cutting off its resources, it's also holding them hostage and occupying Syria's oil fields in the northeast and the breadbasket region where its crops are grown. Last year, Senator Lindsey Graham gleefully exclaimed his approval of the fact that the U.S. had signed a deal with the Kurdish-led SDF to steal Syria's oil, and even gloated about these sadistic Caesar Act sanctions, asking like some bloodthirsty monster whether more were coming.
The Caesar's Act, thank you for using it quickly and in a holding Assad's son accountable is a great first step in what I think will be a long journey to punish his regime. Is more coming?
Yes, Senator.
Thank you. Great job.
According to the latest report from the World Food Program, a record 12.4 million Syrians, that's nearly 60% of the population, are now food insecure. In just over 1 year, an additional 4.5 million Syrians have become food insecure. Sean O'Brien, the World Food Program's representative and country director in Syria, said that the, quote, situation has never been worse. Basic foods to feed a family for a month, bread, rice, lentils, and oil and sugar, now cost at least 120,000 Syrian pounds, which far exceeds the average salaries. Over the last year, food prices across Syria have soared, and the price of basic items has increased by 236%, just as the value of the Syrian pound has plummeted. On average, the price of oil has increased from 1,000 Syrian pounds in January 2020 to 5,000 Syrian pounds in January 2021. UN Special Rapporteur Alina Duhan once again called on the United States to remove unilateral sanctions on Syria, saying, quote, the sanctions violate the human rights of the Syrian people, whose country has been destroyed by almost 10 years of ongoing conflict. The broad sweep of the United States sanctions law that went into effect in June could target any foreigner helping in reconstruction of the devastated country and even employees of foreign companies and humanitarian operators helping rebuild Syria. To talk more about these brutal Caesar Act sanctions that are gripping the Syrian population, journalist Vanessa Bealey joins me from Damascus. Vanessa, thank you for taking the time. I know you don't have a lot of electricity at the moment, ironically, because of the sanctions. How are you doing?
I love how they always term, when I say they, of course, I'm talking about the U.S. coalition, the U.S., U.K., EU, who are imposing these sanctions on the Syrian people. Let's make this really clear. You know, sanctions never target what our governments tell you that they are targeting. They target the people, some of the poorest and some of the most destabilized, traumatized people who have already gone through a 10-year war. You know, the first point I have to make is that Al-Qaeda are not under sanctions. The SDF are not under sanctions. ISIS are not under sanctions inside Syria, right? Let's make that really clear. Humanitarian aid that comes into Bab al-Hawra in Idlib on the border with Turkey is being taken by Al-Qaeda and is being used as part of their mafia operation to provide them with revenue. Okay, so let's make this really clear. Sanctions don't apply to the terrorists and extremist groups and the proxies of the U.S. coalition. They only apply to those people that are living under the protection of the Syrian state and its allies by choice. And you have to remember that the sanctions here are on top of policies like the burning of crops, the occupation of oil resources, and the theft of those oil resources. America doesn't want the oil. It wants to deprive the Syrian people of that oil and to provide revenue for its proxies, in this case, or the Kurdish separatists.
So how are people actually holding up without these commodities and, you know, electricity and gas? Because you see pictures of people lining up for bread now. I've heard stories of people putting on layers of clothes just to keep warm. So how are people managing without these necessities?
The U.S. occupation of the oil means that the refineries under the protection of the Syrian government are not receiving oil supplies. So the electrical power stations are not running efficiently. There is no gas for heating. There's no oil for heating. Yesterday, in fact, I drove past a queue of around 15 kilometers for fuel for cars, right? And this has been the situation since I've been here, which is almost 2 years now. Electricity-wise, we're on 4 hours off, 2 hours on. So effectively, every day, I only really get 6 working hours of electricity, as I call it. In the next suburb, they're lucky if they get 1 hour per day.
Can you maybe describe how much prices have gone up and how much everything has gotten more expensive? Because, you know, you've spent a couple of years in Syria, so, I mean, you've actually known how it was before, even though that was, of course, still during wartime, but still.
Well, I mean, people are always saying to me, for example, a kilo of chicken previously would have been less than 1,000 Syrian pounds, right? Now, with inflation and with the scarcity of food, it's more than 10,000 a kilo. So prices have gone up 10 times. People are still earning, let's say, a Syrian Arab Army soldier is still on a salary of around $50, right? But they're expected to pay 10 times what they were paying before for food, for heating, for gas. I mean, gas now, I think when I first came, it was around 15,000 Syrian pounds for a gas canister. It's now 35,000, 40,000. And you have to queue to get it.
So, Vanessa, what are your thoughts on the mainstream media, especially in the West, how they're reporting on the sanctions or perhaps not reporting?
And it's astounding to me how Western media spins this story. You know, they talk about it all being down to the Assad regime. But in reality, the reason there are bread queues, you know, the Syrian government has maintained its provision of bread throughout the 10 years of this war, despite all of the hardships, the sanctions, the terrorist attacks, etc. And now it can't. But why? Because as we've mentioned, the burning of the crops during the summer across the country, the burning of forestry, the burning of cotton crops, the burning of olive plantations, right? And right now, the SDF, the Kurdish Contras, are stealing the wheat and barley still right now, and they're trading it cross-border, just as they're doing with the oil. And by the way, the oil is providing revenue not only for the SDF, but the SDF are then sending it to Al-Qaeda in Idlib for processing.
How would you describe the morale? How do you see the Syrian people? Are they tolerating it? Are they being resilient? How's the general psychology? And how are they holding up, given that they've gone through so much, so many years of war, and now on top of it, sanctions?
Look, Syrian people, as you know, are incredibly resourceful, incredibly resilient, incredibly steadfast, and as they always do, they're making the best of it. But they're exhausted. You know, as I said before, Syria right now should be rebuilding. For me, I think the most heartbreaking thing is the medical sector. I mean, I had a meeting with the deputy health minister last week. And chronic illnesses, they're just not able to cope with because the machinery and equipment and analysis equipment that they need is breaking down. They can't get spare parts because European countries are not allowed to deal with them. And, you know, the saddest thing, there are doctors. Most of these doctors, Syrian doctors, have trained in the EU. So they have contacts and they have established collaboration in the EU. But they're not allowed to collaborate under the sanctions, even for the medical sector, even for kids that have cancer. You know, this is the insanity that people need to understand. There is nothing humanitarian or protective about sanctions. It is all about destruction. It is all about killing people. Really, sanctions kill people. That's what we need to kind of get into our heads.
According to the latest figures from the United Nations Population Fund, around 30% of the Syrian population are between the ages of 0 and 14. Another 30% of Syrians are between the ages of 10 and 24. That means that 60% of Syria's population is under the age of 24. The vast majority of them have grown up in war, they've grown up with trauma, and on top of it, they're being starved and slowly choked to death now with sanctions. If that isn't heartbreaking and the definition of cruelty, I don't know what is. How on earth does anyone justify putting an entire generation of children through war, depriving them of education, and slowly murdering them with sanctions? These people are sick. They have no conscience. They're cruel. They're evil.